Hi, everybody. Happy New Year's Eve morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. He's scheduled to return on Monday. I will be back with you on Friday. We are observing New Year's Day tomorrow, and there will be special programming in studio, with me this morning, former Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association and former longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm here to kick 2025 out the door.
Right out the door. Fantastic. Also joined by Senior Fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Sarah.
Are you also kicking?
Well, you know, it's coming one way or another. Right?
That's very true.
It will be what it will be.
Que sera, sera. And also investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, is here. Hi, Mark. Good to see you.
Morning. I'm not here to kick, but I am here to ring in. I'm happy to move on and welcome the new year.
Well, that's fantastic. We have one enthusiastically kicking the year out the door, one accepting what comes, and one celebrating the next year. It's a good balance. All righty.
But you know what? We all made it to the end of the year above ground. So for that, we should be grateful.
Indeed. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. We are going to talk about what the panelists have deemed underreported stories of 2025 today. You can feel free to offer your suggestions to that as well by emailing us, and we're going to make some predictions for next year. Feel free to participate in that as well. panel@wamc.org. While we are here at the beginning of the show, I would like to mention as the year wraps up that every not-for-profit that you care about is wishing to hear from you before midnight tonight for, to wrap up their finances in a fine fashion. A lot of fundraising goals exist throughout, you know, arts, community service, etc., and WAMC is no different. If you would like to pledge to support the station, you can always do that at WAMC.org. We shan't harp on it this morning, but I did want to mention it at the top of the show. Appreciate you all very much for helping see the station through a challenging year. We also, as we have mentioned a number of times throughout the last month or so, we lost a panelist this year. Vera Carius Kelly passed away, and Mark Whitman asked if he could remember her at the top of the show this morning. And of course, we would love to share that remembrance as you are ready, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I've not been on since her passing, and I did want to publicly say how appreciative I am of her and what I learned from Dr. Vera Carius Kelly. She was obviously a very important part of this roundtable community long before I got here. When I arrived, she was welcoming, always respectful to me and my family. Even when she and I disagreed vehemently on air, she was consistently affable and generous in her spirit. I did want to focus on what I learned from her. Much of her work was focused, and her advocacy was focused, on engagement around how nations, communities, and individuals treat marginalized groups and minority population. She demonstrated that this question really isn't just incidental, but rather fundamental in her work. She showed how the treatment of marginalized populations illuminate deeper political tensions and even shifts within nations. And she underscored the fact that how we respond to minorities and people who are vulnerable says a lot about not only who we are as nations and communities, but how each of us live as individuals. And it's worth noting that I think many of the listeners know that she actually lived these principles, not only in her research and what she said on these airwaves, but through her direct involvement in organizations that supported those groups. And since at least at the time of Aristotle, the idea of an ethical life has rested on alignment of character, judgment, and action. And Vera's work and her conduct reflected those ideals. And I thought on the last day it was appropriate to look back and think about how appreciative we are for her, and specifically I am, for what I learned from her. And after a moment of remembrance and appreciation, I also believe it's entirely appropriate to carry on the work that she did so well as we continue to exchange and share ideas at the roundtable.
I agree completely with everything you said, and I really appreciate you thinking it through and sharing it. We'll miss her forever. A wonderful, wonderful person to the world and to the show and to each of us. And thank you for that, Mark. Oh, all righty. Where Where would you like to begin, Mark, with an underreported story of the year? Let's have you pick one of yours to begin.
Okay. The you know, Sarah, I sent you a list of things that in my world should have been more focused on. And as I looked at that list last night, I realized that I missed the number one item, which is the conflict in Sudan between the RSF and the Sudanese Defense Forces. If you look at the cost of that conflict, I think it's clear that there's the estimates of 150,000 dead directly as a result of that conflict are pretty well accepted. And the estimates of the indirect deaths are in the hundreds of thousands. And there are a couple reasons why this isn't widely covered. The first is, frankly, these are people of color. And we care less about that in the world broadly than we should generally. And secondly, there's sort of no easy bad and good guy in this argument. Both the government forces and the RSF are bad guys. The struggle is not really about ideology or religion. It's about two groups who want more power. And they're being backed indirectly by Dubai on one side and Dubai and the United Arab Emirates are widely seen as backing the RSF. And Egypt and Saudi Arabia are backing the Sudanese army for their purposes. But it's the United States isn't directly involved in the conflict. Frankly, I don't know that we in the U.S. care all that much who prevails. And so it's not something that you read a lot about, but it is probably the conflict that in the last so many years has led to more suffering and more death than anywhere else on the planet. And we don't talk about it for the reasons that I discussed. So I do think it's worth at least mentioning it. And as we think about the difficulties around the world, it's worth keeping that one in mind, even though it's not an easy discussion topic. From the United States' standpoint, there is something we could do between the UAE, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, and to some extent Egypt, if the United States were to apply force with respect to those groups and get them to stop backing the various sides there. It's reasonable to expect that you could bring at least a large cessation or a meaningful cessation of the conflict sooner than would otherwise happen. But like I said, because of its lack of visibility, very few people here in the United States have decided that that's worth putting to the top of the list when we talk about putting pressure on our political figures.
I have a question for you, Mark. The point that you made up top about we tend to devalue or pay less attention to conflicts when they affect people of color is well observed. That said, why is there no campus activism about this? In other words, or is there, and I've just missed it? In other words, you do tend to get a more progressive lens, if you like, on world affairs through the lens of student activism, but there has been none as far as I know.
I think there's very little. And again, there's no easy bad guy and good guy. They're kind of both the RSF and the Sudanese forces are bad guys in this context. Hmm. And so it's hard to say, obviously the Sudanese are losing by the hundreds of thousands, right? But it's hard to say, well, these are the good guys we want to win, and here's the bad guy, and here's the simple answer. You need to go, to four states in the Middle East, at least four states with whom we have troubled, multifaceted relationships, and use a marker and say, you guys all have to sort of come together and knock this off. So I think the fact that it doesn't have a good guy and a bad guy, and it doesn't have an easy answer, further complicate activism around the problem. And also even a discussion about it. I mean, it's sort of other than saying, boy, it really stinks, and then sorting through who the parties that are funding this are, it's hard to say, well, this is the easy answer. It's not like, well, if we back Zelensky and the Ukrainians, we're doing, quote unquote, the right thing, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a real humanitarian crisis in Sudan. And I have read stories about efforts to get humanitarian aid and relief in there, and it's always difficult when you have such violence going on. So you see occasional stories about it, but, I mean, this has been a drawn-out issue for probably a decade. The the inability of Americans or even Europeans to fully address the issues in what we used to call third world countries that are suffering violence, suffering poverty, suffering a drought. I mean, we see this again and again. Sometimes it comes up when we talk about climate stories, but I saw a few stories this year about this, but not a ton.
There is a funding collapse. The UN, as you've mentioned, the UN announced it has been forced to have its 2026 appeal to $23 billion due to donor fatigue, and consequently the World Food Program warned it must cut food rations by 70% starting in January, affecting communities already facing famine. And Sudan tops that emergency list. The International Rescue Committee placed Sudan at the top of its emergency watch list for 2026, citing the convergence of conflict, economic collapse, and shrinking international support. This from Al Jazeera. So that is something not discussed enough, and we will, you know, hopefully pay more attention to it in the coming year. Shall we launch another story, Robert?
Sure. And no, Mark, you know, kudos to you. You're right. As I, you know, in preparing for this discussion, I didn't even think of that. And you're absolutely right. It's an enormous story that did not receive enough coverage. So when I was making my list of, okay, what are stories that we have not talked about enough this year? This is somewhat counterintuitive because it's because we have talked a lot about artificial intelligence, but maybe we have not had the conversation we need to have about it. I was noting off microphone, I used to work at Time Magazine back in the day, and their Man of the Year, I'm sorry, they now call it Person of the Year, has gotten a little bit off the beaten track in the last couple of years. But this year, I think they got it right. They named the Architects of AI as their Persons of the Year. Look, I'm not one of those people who thinks, you know, the machines are going to take over and kill us all. But I don't know that we are fully grappling with the implications of artificial intelligence. I mean, I work in education, so for years we've been thinking about, you know, not just AI, but what happens when you have boxcar numbers of young people, and typically our poorest and, you know, least with the fewest safety nets, you know. If you are working in food service, if you are driving, you know, a truck or a car around, and now, frankly, middle class jobs, you know, those of us who put words on paper and whatnot, there's an awful lot of disruption coming, and it will almost certainly affect not just low income people, but increasingly skilled labor, if you like, you know, educated labor. And it's happening awfully fast. I don't think that we have really fully grappled with the disruptive effects of artificial intelligence. And beyond that, Sarah, there's a sense, a good friend of mine, Ed Jones, who lives in Ohio, was talking to me about this. Just the pace of change. Like, okay, I'm fairly well adapted to life in a technological age. You know, I write for a living, I speak for a living, I'm comfortable online, etc.
As far as you know.
As far as I know, that's right. And there's sometimes I feel like, whoa, it's just happening too fast. And if I, as a fairly well adapted person, feel that way, what must it be like to be a, you know, either a marginally or, you know, or uneducated person who is just not prepared for what's about to hit them?
Yeah, I think some of those people are just checking out and saying, "Yeah, oh, I'm just going to, I don't know, play golf or go hunting or do something else." You know, with AI, what I saw was like the nibbling around the edges in terms of experimentation, problems. Some people are setting up guardrails. Some people are establishing policies about use of artificial intelligence. Some people are not. I think I'm seeing some industries try to self-regulate, mm-hmm. and some just saying, you know, well, let's break it, and if they break it, then we'll fix it as we go forward. It really is an issue for people as you go forward. I can't tell you the number of times I've seen a story or a tweet or a meme and saying, "Is this real?"
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People self doubt, you know, what's real and what's not. And going forward, I just hope the coming year brings us some way, or the industry gives us some way of verifying what's real and what's not. What's artificial? Label it somehow. That's my big wish for the new year, a labeling system.
Yeah, but we could also be entering a world, Judy, where we simply need less people to do what we need to do in, you know, economically. What happens, you know, what is the answer for folks, and again, not just those who are on the economic margins, but who are now what we'd firmly call middle class, who suddenly are either de-skilled or whose skills can be mechanized. I've made a dark joke about this for years about, you know, in the debate about universal basic income. What about universal basic dignity? You know, what happens when there are tens of millions of us in the foreseeable future who are functionally obsolete?
Well, a little bit happened and when the factories started to close,
right.
You know, and then all the factory workers were told, well, you're going to get an IT job. And, you know, they where did it go?
Yeah.
I think there'll be a tremendous amount of change. And I think it'll lead to a lot of difficulties. But I'm not afraid because I think in pieces we as a country and as a world have seen this movie before.
Fair point.
I think if you look, for instance, I think financially about the railroads in the 18th century, mm-hmm. which were they were the tech of the 18th century in terms of they took on huge investment in regional railroads. If the railroad came to your town, it boomed. If you speculated that the railroad was coming to your town and it didn't, you lost tremendous sums, some cases, in some instances, fortunes. When the railroads missed projections and they defaulted, that led to bank failures. And there was a panic in both, I think, 1873 and 1893.
There were several.
That led to – the 93 led to a pretty severe depression. We don't talk about it because the Great Depression is the model we think about. But I think from a – from a financial standpoint, you can still have lots of mini failures, and many of these firms will fail and still have large successes. If you think about the tech boom, you know, Amazon's a perfect example of that. And I know we're getting close to a break, so maybe we can talk about some of the human factors of it on the other side of that break.
If I may, I agree with you, Mark. The only difference, I think, between – because you're right. I mean, you know railroads, electricity have been disruptive technologies. The difference here is the speed. That this is happening not over the course of generations, it's happening within the course of years and months.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will return to this topic and discuss the human factors, as Mark suggests, after a news break from the BBC. In studio today with Judy Patrick, Robert Pondicio, and Mark Whitman. Again, the email address is panel@WAMC.org. Feel free to share your thoughts on underreported stories or predictions for the coming year. Again, the email address, panel@WAMC.org. Welcome back to this New Year's Eve morning edition of the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc, here with Judy Patrick, Robert Pondicio, and Mark Whitman. Take it away, Mark.
Oh, I just wanted to, on the whole artificial intelligence, I talked about the economics of it. I do think there'll be crashes. I think they'll have wider effects, although we hopefully in this country have learned how to put fire rings around banks. So I think it'll obviously lead to a lot of displacement in the labor market. But this theory that we're all going to be sitting around looking for something to do, nonsense. I look back, if you look, for instance, in New York City or Brooklyn Heights, and there's probably areas in Albany that are the same where there are these carriage houses below, behind the row houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the day when automobiles came out and the folks in the carriage house said, we're done for. They're not going to need us to feed, water, groom, shoe these horses. What in the world are we going to do for a living? And what's happened since? Well, let's think about transportation, right? We build superhighways that we transport goods on. We take vacations on them. We fly goods around the world now in transportation. We take vacations and employ mm-hmm. people. We will find a use for everyone. It will be very different than it would have been had AI not arrived. But like the people back in the sitting back in the stable, if you define yourself as only one your manual task, you're dead in the water economically. If you think more broadly about what's available in the world, we will not all be sitting around waiting for Elon Musk to send us a check around universal income. It's total nonsense. And as for the Terminator day, I do not fear that day. But here is the day I do fear, and I've seen it already. I sat at the airport, and if you sat at the airport 20 years ago. on the day when, quote unquote, the computers went down, the airlines would look at you and just say, well, it's the systems. And they would throw up their hands and look at you as if they didn't have direct control over everything that was happening in their system. You fast forward to maybe 5 or 10 years ago, they would say the systems, but they would immediately say they had learned that the public held them responsible for the systems that they used. And they would say, well, working on it, you would get a letter after the fact with some menial compensation that acknowledged the fact that they as an organization were responsible for the systems. As we hand more over to AI, there is the risk that you're standing at the airport and the person at the counter looks at you and just says, well, it's the AI. But this thing, it won't do anything that we don't ask or permit it to do. And eventually, these holding organizations responsible will evolve and will get to the right point where if you want to use it to service clients or customers or do something better, that's fine. But you're responsible when it doesn't go well as well.
Yes and no, Mark. I mean, on the one hand, let me go back to your transportation thing, first of all, because, look, I agree with you. Economically, who is it who preaches the gospel of creative destruction that's been part of our economy?
Schumpeter.
Yeah. Yep. That's been part of our economic lives forever. But in terms of transportation, let's say you were born in 1899 when you were 4 years old, the Wright brothers flew. When you were 70 years old, men walked on the moon. That's over the course of a lifetime, not over the course of weeks or months or years.
It still sounds pretty fast, doesn't it?
Right, but, air but to now the moon. Imagine that pace of change on steroids, and that's the thing that is potentially disorienting. So yes, we will find productive uses of our time in the long term. It's the short term that bothers me. The potential disorientation could be both politically and socially destabilizing. On your example of the airlines or whatnot, look, and I'm guilty of viewing everything through the lens of education because it's the work that I do. We're seeing a phenomenon now with AI where it functionally hollows out learning. It's possible for students, for example, to turn in work that is AI generated, that is polished and smart. And no thinking went into it. So in other words, that's the thing that concerns me, is that it's not just de-skilling of the workforce. It's the, I'm trying to coin a phrase here, de-savvying, de-intellectualizing. It's hollowing out our competence. I mean, yes, you're right, Mark, that it can only do what we ask it to do. But as we offload more of our cognition to it, we ourselves become less skilled and less intelligent.
I agree that there's a risk. I think educators need to protect against that risk. My wife is a college professor. If you need to have kids write essays.
Blue book. Bring back the blue
book.
Right,
in a blue book, right, without a PC. By the way, there's a funny meme about students handing in AI work, and the professor says, well, that's okay because I use AI to check it.
To grade it,
so,
right.
Yeah, so it's all okay. But and frankly, when you get to college, at some point, you got to take on responsibility for your own learning. And if you wanted to avoid that under the current system, you could, largely. And unless educators are careful about how they enforce learning.
So you were never a kid then, Mark? You don't remember what it's like to just take the easy path out and turn do Cliff's Notes or whatnot?
I
love the idea of taking responsibility for your own learning, but I also know what kids do.
I get it. But look, the education system to some extent needs to set up protections against it. And ultimately, when you graduate an adult into the world,
catches up.
Yeah, you better hope that not only have they learned the substantive material you're teaching, but they've learned the principles around why they want to understand that. And I think AI will make that even more important. My son and I were talking on the drive up today. He was saying, "Oh, when I get a breakaway in hockey, I don't even think. I've done it. I practiced so many times." But then we were saying that if I asked you about your 20-second breakaway and you want to discuss it, you could write a 5-minute story about all the layers that went through the non-thinking that went on in your head and what happened. And you could literally write something that would take 5 minutes to read over a 10-second period. And I said, well, that's the amazing part of our brains. And that's why I don't worry about AI. Someone's always going to need, in the world of finance, someone's going to need me to check a heck of a lot of this work for as far as my eye can see, no matter how smart the AI is, frankly, because it can't do what my son described you know, what he does sort of, as he says, almost naturally now, on a 10-second breakaway that takes him 5 minutes to unwind after the fact. I think it's great. I use it a lot. I tell my son, you know, look for ways to use it. Mm-hmm. I don't fear it at all. That is not to say that the pace of disruption isn't going to be torrid, that the disruption won't be painful. And that's where keeping our political system and our political leaders in a responsible for how they treat us as a society is key. And frankly, we failed as a country when we globalized. We thought, well, if we're raising all boats, then of course that's good for everyone. It was a fallacy, because the fact that this is a lot of what you're seeing now with the measures of GDP going up and growth, and everybody saying, well, everybody must be okay because the economy seems really healthy. But we're leaving sections of this economy behind. We've done it in small order on globalization. There is a larger risk with AI that we do that if we're not careful. And the good news, at least, is that we have an example of having made the mistake already that we need to be more careful about. If I may, I could transition into one of my other underreported. Is that okay?
Yeah, that sounds great.
It relates to this, which is, if anyone has the inclination to do so, I would recommend to them, Michael W. Green wrote something on Substack about the poverty line. It was picked up on CNN and a little bit in the Washington Post. I don't think nearly enough. And it helps explain, when we talk about affordability, what particularly we mean for those who are most economically vulnerable in the United States. America still defines poverty using a framework that was designed in the 60s. Basically, our definition of poverty is 3 times the food budget for a family of whatever size we're looking at. It used to work as a rule of thumb because food dominated household spending in the United States. But today, if you look at the costs of housing, childcare, transportation, healthcare, and even digital access, right? Many of these costs challenge or eclipse the spending. So basically, the old measure of the poverty line is now entirely irrelevant, but politicians and even policy wonks use it because it's convenient and it's easy, and politicians use it particularly because it gets them off the hook for the fact that if you look at the true cost to participate as a family of with two earners in the modern economy, it is legions more expensive than it used to be because of some of the bizarre ways that we measure inflation. One of them is, if you look at cars and you say, well, I'm just going to go buy the cheapest car out there. Well, in the 60s, you could buy a car without anti-lock brakes, without a backup camera, without automatic seatbelts, right? And so, and when you're adjusted, when you look at inflation, you adjust for those costs. You assume that today's car always existed in the data series, because that's the only appropriate way to look at inflation. But if you, or it's, we've decided that's the appropriate way. But when you look at the entry costs as the second earner in a family into the workforce, you can't go buy a 1960s car. It's illegal. You have to spend for all of the accoutrements that may well benefit you or benefit society. So the point of this author was that we don't look at the cost to these families of entering the workforce and having two earners and what it truly costs, and the poverty measure is irrelevant now. And depending on where you are in the nation, it can be a six-figure salary that talks about basically where being comfortable and able to live without sort of fear of economic failure nipping at your heels versus falling into that. And there's also, this author talks about a huge chasm. We have support functions in place that help families that are the most vulnerable. But as they start to go from subsistence level to some measure of economic security, if you look at how we curtail their government assistance, we actually take away quicker than they earn during that period in the chasm, during that traverse of the chasm. So it actually initially costs them money to basically try to ascend economically. And the other fallacy is this fallacy that, well, if you fail once, that's okay. You dust yourself off and you get back on the horse and you get at it. But with credit ratings, availability to the housing market and other measures, it is not the case that you fail and you simply dust yourself off. You actually get reclassified as an individual for whom things are more expensive. Mm. So, it's worse than just dusting yourself off. And again, this piece by Michael Green, there's been some discussion in the for people who are wonky about this, about what the right number is and his calculations and some of the assumptions he makes. But it's Michael W. Green. You can find it on Substack. I actually got access. I signed up without paying any money and got the four posts that constitute this body of work. And it also talks about his prescriptions for the answer. But I think underreported, there's been no shortage of the affordability crisis discussion, but there has not been, until this piece in my mind, a very succinct but intelligent discussion of why it is that there are so many people in this economy who feel so economically vulnerable. And there's a great adage that economists use, which is there's a man standing with his head in an oven and his feet in an ice block. And the doctor says, well, you better get your head out of the oven because you're going to burn, and your feet out of the ice block because you're going to get frostbite. The economist walks in and says, well, on average, the guy's okay. Don't worry about it. So many of the economic measures that we use in this country are reflective of that man with his head in the furnace and his feet in the ice block. They do not reflect the difficulties that the economically vulnerable have in this nation. We haven't looked carefully at that for years, and we've suffered in our understanding and our ability to prescribe policies that will help people. That is another one of my woefully underreported stories.
We will hear from the other panelists on this after a brief underwriting break. You are listening to the Roundtable Panel. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Judy Patrick, Robert Pondicio, and Mark Whitman. We are discussing the economy. And it's bad. Robert.
Sure, I was going to defer to Judy.
Oh, sorry.
I guess I'm a little bit curious, Mark, about why you feel like we have not been talking about affordability. I feel like that's going to be the political buzzword of 2026 if we can transition into making predictions. It got Mamdani elected mayor. Trump has been on the affordability bandwagon, et cetera. And also, if I can nuance it a little bit, most of my career in education has been aimed at improving the educational fortunes, hence the economic fortunes of low-income students, with an eye towards upward mobility. 25 years ago, we were preaching everybody must go to college because of the wage premium associated with college. Now that has fallen into more or less disrepute, and now it's what are the skills that are going to be necessary to be economically viable. And at the risk of going back into artificial intelligence, that feels very, very much in play for me. So I guess I'm less concerned with the economic definitions, poverty, what's above and below the poverty line, as opposed to are we having the conversation about economic viability? In other words, I have a 27-year-old daughter. Will young people of her generation not achieve, something we're very proud of in this country and have been for generations? Every generation does a little bit better than mom and dad. That feels like it's stalled at this point. And I don't know, and at the risk of being pessimistic, I'm not sure I see, those at the high end will do very well. Those at the low end may struggle their entire lives to not just to get ahead, but to keep up.
These are abstract concepts. And in journalism, one of the things we try to do is be more concrete or specific. And that helps people understand some of these abstract concepts better. If you sit down with a family that makes $120,000 a year and they say that it costs us $1,000 a month for childcare, if we're putting this much away for college, if you break down the budget really in a detailed way, it helps the rest of Americans understand why someone who is bringing in $120,000 a year is still struggling. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I see occasionally. I don't see enough. And the other problem is it's anecdotal. So any one family is not representative of the rest of the world. So, I can remember back in the 70s, I saw a nice news report of someone who made $120,000. And I think it was CBS News did it. And they broke down and I could understand, they had to pay this much money to dock their yacht. I mean, and then they thought that that was really important. I mean, and so it gave you some perspective about where people put their priorities. And it just piles up. You know, it's the $6 loaf of bread. It's the, you know, it's the $5 quart of orange juice. It pile, you know, one thing you can live with. I mean, the eggs have gone down, but the grocery bills, the health insurance going up,
more than double for thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, that was something to really not look forward to. You know, the cost of a car, like $50,000 for a car, even for an old car. The cost of car repairs is enormous. The cost of tires also very, very high. So as all of mine go flat. So
right.
So it's the specifics that sometimes will drive these points home in a way that the abstract concepts will not.
Back to my point about the pace of change. I'm still old enough to remember when six-figure income was synonymous with not just, you know, comfort, but wealth. Like, you're doing great. You have a six-figure income. It's going to take me a while before I'm used to thinking of that as scraping by.
But again, the real problem, and this is from Michael Green, is not where the poverty line is drawn, but how long, costly, and unforgiving the climb is.
Mm-hmm.
And once support fades, you know, how the setbacks carry real lasting penalties for people who are trying to ascend the economic ladder. And my point about underreporting is not that the word affordability has not been bandied about enough.
It's been abused, if anything.
Yeah, but it's
why, a brand new word.
But why
that was made up?
Yeah. But why
to hurt
is
President
it?
Trump.
But why is it that Biden and Trump, when they were point to the economic statistics, right, and they say, well, on average, the guy is fine. Don't look too closely at his feet in the ice or his head in the oven. Every measure I have of the economy says that you folks should be happy with what I've done. What is your problem? That article and the discussion around it are the answer to what's the problem. And we need to understand the problem in order to have a prescription. And the prescription is far-reaching. If you look at income tax rates where they are now on individual incomes as opposed to corporate incomes and where they were historically, you can start to get some answer as to why individuals feel so burdened. It's not a mistake. There's actually and this is in the prescription part of it. Now, no one's going to buy all of any one person's prescription in this case. But I do think, you know, the theory, I love it when conservatives say, well, what the, you know, just because they're rich, they should be penalized. It actually presupposes that the system that allowed them to be rich wasn't one where the government is got its tentacles and fingers in what's permitted and what's taxed and what's not taxed. This whole economic system is a set of rules that no one person could read during a lifetime. So if Jeff Bezos is a zillionaire, it's not just because of Jeff Bezos. It's because he played a game, and the rule book that he played by is interminably long, and he benefited from it. What we are saying is if we look decades on as we played the game the way we've looked at it, that this concentration of wealth and the difficulties of those who are less fortunate, the rule book has left us with this great divide that's getting worse. And I have news for you. Look at any society in the long run. If that divide gets too wide and it looks like it will not be addressed by the system, the people who are on the wrong side of that divide will burn down the system. They have done it historically, literally and figuratively, every time it's gotten too bad. And so we as a democracy, if we want to talk about, you know, our 250th year and another 250 years, have to think about our rule book and playing under a different set of rules, because the way this one's going is not one that prescribes the long-term success of our economic and therefore political system.
I called for listeners to share the stories that they thought were underreported, and in the last few minutes of this hour, I'm going to run through some of those before we go to a newscast, send Judy off for a media project taping, and then continue our discussion. You're coming back, though, right?
I will.
Great.
I will.
Fantastic. We will miss you. Russ writes in and says, as underreporting goes, and perhaps this is contestable, but my vote is on the least reported story of the year would be the success of the Republican Party's agenda. Not only have they reversed the gains in health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, but they have made vast reversals in the regulation of private business, allowing all kinds of pollution and financial risk to flourish, all while enacting cuts to the taxes of wealthy people, befitting the relaxed regulatory environment. So some things we've hit on there framed differently, but another one is Jay wrote in and said, I think an underreported story is how there is still an ongoing hiring freeze and an emphasis on downsizing, at least within the DOI, by what they call attrition in not rehiring and not letting positions get filled.
What's a DOI?
Not sure. Might be DEI.
The interior?
I'm not sure. Sorry, guys. I should have maybe not read that one.
That's all right.
Only because I
don't use
acronyms. Defend it. Right, exactly. Sarah, not me, but another Sarah, wrote in and said, I think that the climate crisis and pollution of materials like microplastics and PFAS are underreported. Not that they go unreported, but they are life-threatening context to their unabated logical extreme, and they should be the context with which most of our decisions are made. The magnitude and pervasiveness of these stories make our behavior and what we do focus on look very, very shameful. They also dovetail with and can reframe most other issues, conflict, poverty, the basic ideas of self-reliance, and so on. Another listener wrote in with a similar point about framing most stories through climate. I'm not finding the email right now. Apologies to that listener. Maxine wrote in, and says, the rise of anti-Semitism, the rise of incidents large and small, a tweet by Elon Musk that Jews are white but not, quote, peak white, was reported by the Times of London, but not as far as I can tell in the New York Times. That was from Maxine. We also heard from Dave, who says the flaws in the American Constitution are an underreported story for this year. Panel at WAMC.org to continue your suggestions for underreported stories you'd like to mention or predictions for 2026. The roundtable will continue with Robert Pondicio and Mark Whitman and adding back in Judy Patrick ASAP. After this, it's time now for a newscast from Ray Graff. Welcome back to the roundtable panel for this New Year's Eve morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, who is, by all accounts, enjoying a well-earned vacation and should return Monday, scheduled to return on Monday. The panel this morning, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio, investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, and former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association and longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick, who is currently recording the media project but will return to us post-haste. So I'm in studio now with Robert and Mark. Where are we going, guys?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to wag my finger at you, Sarah, because you did not tell us that Mark and I would be having to carry the load here for the next half hour. Thanks for dropping that bomb.
Surprise!
On us.
Yeah. You can do it. I believe in you.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, let me interject a dark note, or play Cassandra, if you like. You know, if you remember Greek mythology, you know, Cassandra was the one who had the gift of foresight, but no one believed her. So I hope that people will believe me on this one, but I'm willing to risk it. Maybe, I don't know if I'd call this undercovered, but maybe under-discussed. I'm really concerned about what I would call the soft normalization of political violence. All right, I'm 63 years old. I am old enough to remember the 60s. Thank you. The 60s and 70s. When I tell people this data point, they literally don't believe it, but look it up. I promise you it's true. And I think from 70 to 71, there were 1,200 domestic bombings in this country. Those of us who remember the 60s and 70s, it wasn't just the assassinations of high-profile figures like the Kennedys, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, etc. My dad worked for the airlines when I was a kid. Hijackings were normal. I shouldn't say normal. They were common. I grew up in an era where political violence was just, it was the water in which we swam. And I fear it's coming back. This year we saw the assassination of Charlie Kirk and some folks, frankly, saying he deserved it. And even more disturbing to me was because I discount nattering on social media. People are always going to say silly and irresponsible things, but when And interestingly enough, I'm blanking on his name, the healthcare CEO.
Oh, goodness. I'll look it up.
But interestingly, I can remember the name of the guy who killed him.
Yes, indeed.
Luigi Mangione. What does that tell you? Where you had this formulation that went, well, of course violence is
Brian
wrong.
Brian Thompson
Thank
is the
you,
CEO
Brian
of
Thompson,
United
and shame on me for remembering not him, but his killer. You had grown-ups, elected officials, saying things like, well, of course violence is wrong. However, folks, we can't do that, okay? We just cannot allow ourselves to put moral conditions on acts of violence. Deepen the analysis a little bit further, you know, as somebody who works in education, I'm horror-struck by polls that show an alarming number of young people, you know, one-third, 40%, as many as half, believe that under certain circumstances, political violence is acceptable. Again, those of us who remember the 60s and 70s are hearing warning bells over this. Once you make a moral exemption for an act of violence, then they spread. Then if you can allow it for this condition, then you can allow it for that condition. So I don't want to make a prediction here because I very much want to be wrong about this, Sarah. But I'm really concerned that we are starting to creep back into that 60s and 70s era of the normalization of political violence.
Mark?
I do worry about that. I think you missed the poster child for this, which is J6th, and you talked about hijackings. I look at what's happening with respect to January 6th is the following. We had a group that decided they didn't like where our airplane was going, and they hijacked it. Fortunately, we subdued them. We brought them before the courts, many of them. We arguably perhaps didn't get the leader before the courts. And now we're back in the airport, and these folks are milling around with us behind security because they've all been released. And I do fear for the midterms with respect to that, frankly. I think anyone who doesn't think that the Republicans and the administration are already thinking about what they're going to do with the close races in blue states in the midterms, you're not thinking ahead, and I guarantee you they are. I don't know necessarily that we'll get to violence, but I wouldn't entirely rule it out given what we saw. And so when you talk about underreporting, I think you've got a whole group within this country, including elected officials who are currently in office, who don't want to look too hard at condemning political violence because they and their leader have benefited from looking away, and they're still trying to scrape plaques off the wall and rewrite history as we speak. So I think the danger is real and persistent. And until and unless enough time fades without a recurrence, or if we treat January 6th properly and disqualify those directly involved from elected office, I think we face a real risk.
Yeah. I guess an associated danger here is that it has never been, I don't want to say easy, but it's never been more likely that small numbers of people can enact a grudge on a fatal level. I mean, the classic example would be 9/11, which was, 19 people and $250,000, basically, is what, and it engendered a multi-trillion dollar response.
Ended many lives.
Yes, of course. So I mean that is a fact of life in this century is that it has just never been easier to enact a grudge fatally. We see it all the time. I mean, one of the letter writers invoked anti-Semitism. That's an associated problem here, and a very, very serious one, where we've seen any number of acts of anti-Semitic violence. Whether it's lone wolves or something more organized is neither here nor there. It's destabilizing, it's disturbing, and it is becoming shockingly common.
I do think this listener is taking tone with you with this question, but I think we'll ask it anyway, if you don't mind. How does Robert feel about the extrajudicial murders of people in boats? The real violence is coming from Trump and company.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've actually talked about this on past roundtables. I'm not a fan of it's not just the violence, the permission structure that the Trump administration grants itself by branding these folks narco-terrorists, as opposed to just drug traffickers, which would as a justification for military action. And I don't want this to sound like whataboutism. However, this is not new to this administration. The Obama administration, we looked it up last time I was on the roundtable. I don't remember what the number was, but it was in the thousands of drone strikes, including strikes that killed American citizens. I don't want to ever get into the game of it's okay when my guy does it, it's not okay when your guy does it.
Oh, I don't think you need to get to that game to condemn what this current administration is doing in a unique way. And it is as follows. First of all, let's establish the most awesome power that a state has is the sanctioned use of violence. The most awesome power we give to our president is the ability to end lives. It's understood in the Constitution and how we've practiced it up until this administration that that's to be done with congressional oversight. The people, the Congress in a republic, the proxy for us as a people. There is, I don't want to rule out the fact that there was a world in which you could lay out all of the details behind what Trump is doing and get comfortable with what's been done. And that, whether you like it or not, is what was done in the Obama administration. But what I cannot countenance, our Constitution doesn't countenance, and none of us should countenance, is a system where they don't present the facts and the rationale behind what they've done to the people or our representatives. Robert, I get the analogy between what Obama did and what Trump is doing, but I would caution everyone. I understand how it's relevant in some ways, but it falls down in one key fact, which is that they have not laid bare their rationale or the evidence that they have for what they do. We don't know that the boats that had multiple people on them, which would be really strange if you're transporting only drugs because you want to maximize space for the drugs. We don't know if that was a human trafficking boat that may also have not or not had drugs on it, where we killed a bunch of innocents. I rue the day when we find out that one of those boats that we blew up had people who had no involvement in the drug trade for one reason or the other on it. And frankly, if I was Maduro and that happens, I would make sure the world knew it the instant it did. I fear that you could even envision a situation in which he creates that outcome and then advertises it. But I do think it is worthwhile when we look back at what's happened in the past year and we talk about what we haven't examined closely enough. The sanctioning the president to use lethal power without proper oversight is something that all of us should take umbrage with.
Let me see you and raise you. I would argue that an overdue conversation, and maybe this can be, in, whether it's under-discussed in 2025 or a prediction for 2026, Sarah, either way, it's fine with me. We need to have a long, hard conversation about presidential power. And I'm thinking of the pardon power here as well. I think both parties have now embarrassed themselves thoroughly in the overuse of presidential power or pardon power. I'm heartened to see Congress stepping up on the Venezuelan boat issue. Republicans in Congress, for example, demanding hearings and whatnot. I've joked that Congress has been, on the back of a milk carton for quite a while now. Like, well, you've got a job to do. You're a co-equal branch of government. Act like it. One hopes or one would prefer that we didn't get to that point through excess uses of presidential power. But this has now been going on for several administrations where each one seems to want to up the ante and assume, whether it's through executive order, through pardons, through military action, et cetera. We've just seen successive administrations just assuming prerogatives that may or may not be constitutional. So as a former civics teacher, it's about time we had this conversation about the limits of presidential authority.
Tristan wrote in on this topic and says, if you don't want political violence normalized, then you need to provide nonviolent alternatives to address the grievances. Elections don't do it anymore because the oligarchs have purchased all three branches of government. Mark said it earlier, if you don't address the growing divide, those on the short end will burn the system down. Jared wrote in and says, it really bothers me that Charlie Kirk is still getting so much attention when political violence is mentioned, but we rarely hear Melissa Hortman's name mentioned. This, according to Jared, her story is far more disturbing than Charlie Kirk's, where a lone wolf gunman showed up at her home and shot her and her husband and then went to another representative's house and attempted to assassinate them, too. Unfortunately, most everyone has forgotten about them when speaking on this issue, and they would rather speak of Kirk. I think it's an oversimplification of the intentions, but I do think it is absolutely worth mentioning Melissa Hortman and her
husband. Sure, and if I can add on, Sarah, if I was insufficient in saying this is a both sides problem, then let me say it clearly right now. I don't believe that this is unique to one side of the political spectrum or the other.
Oh, I want to respectfully disagree. I think the right and their leadership have endorsed violence. I think that you can't get past J6. I mean, you can't tell me it doesn't matter that the guy sitting in the Oval Office used the Cheney words, right? Summoned, incited, and directed a mob, and that he hasn't been held to account for it. And then tell me there's both sidesism we should.
I don't know.
I don't get me wrong. Both sides have committed fouls. Everybody belongs in the penalty box. But there's one team where a number of players should have had a game misconduct or a season misconduct, and we couldn't even figure out that as a country. So I don't like the
Charlie Kirk notwithstanding, the Luigi Mangione one was the one that really made my blood run cold. I mean, you had Elizabeth Warren and others functionally justifying it. What was her name? The Washington Post reporter, Taylor Lorenz, discussing Luigi Mangione like she was a writer for 16 or Tiger Beat, for Pete's sake, you know, talking about how handsome and moral he was. Like, give me a break.
Yeah, but I guess the one thing I would say is when people mention violence and they say, well, somebody who was on the quote unquote on the left endorsed it, they're not on my team. My team,
mine either.
You can't be on my team. But the problem the other team has is their leader. You can't get past that. So the both sidesism. Again, nobody's innocent, but to say both sides are equal. And you have this guy, I mean, look at his Truth Social posts, for God's sake, what he said about Somalians. I mean, give me a break that this is both sides are equally guilty. Both sides are guilty, yes. Both sides are equally guilty, save me.
If that makes you sleep better at night, Mark, that you want to say that, you know, the scale's on one side or the other, then, as my people do not say, mazel tov.
Paul wrote in and says, political violence seems to be in the DNA of this country, starting with the American Revolution, War of 1812, various rebellious and fighting with Native people, slavery, clashes between pro and anti-slavery, John Brown, Harper's Ferry, Civil War, Redeemer, overthrowing state governments in the South, labor riots and rebellions, race riots, Red Scares, Klan violence, segregationist violence, and church bombings. I could go on.
Didn't even mention Reconstruction, which the levels of political violence that greeted the end of the Civil War were medieval. Horrifying.
Maybe a controversial one, but I always think about the Stonewall riots, right? Mm-hmm. Which is another case of, if you talk to people, you could claim it was all self-defense, but it was certainly violence.
Paul continues, so we cannot deny it has been there in American DNA, but we need to move away from it and embrace democracy fully and all renounce the violence. I think
here.
Putting a button.
That's a great note, because I do think as we approach the 250th anniversary, right? I mean, we started through less than peaceful terms on this enterprise. We've expanded it and altered it using violence. But the answer is we got to move away from it.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that I'm trying to be measured here, and I don't want to argue with my respected fellow panelists, one of the reasons that I reject the one side is worse than the other, even if both sides are guilty, is because that creates a permission structure for retribution. Well, what, you know, if we allow this, then you can't complain when that happens. And I just think that's the road to hell.
I think there is that risk. I don't think it logically follows that's the conclusion you draw.
If only people were governed by logic, then I would agree with you.
Speaking of the history of America and the 250th anniversary, the semiquincentennial.
Is that how it's said?
Semiquincentennial.
Easy for you to say.
Is one of your predictions for next year relates to that, Robert. Let's talk about that.
It's not a prediction, but I can't thank you enough, Sarah, for just the invitation to kind of think through the top stories of 2025 and, you know, for whatever passes for a crystal ball.
It was Mark's idea.
Get it out.
Yeah, and I appreciate it too.
Great idea. I've been thinking a lot about this, and I may write a piece about this somewhere. So I'm 63 years old. I was 13 years old in 1976, the bicentennial year. So, if you're under the age of 60, this may not resonate with you. But when I think back about who I am and the things that shaped my life, in retrospect, the bicentennial played an enormous role in my life. So I was in eighth grade, which is the year in Long Island where we did U.S. history. The movie 1776 was our Hamilton. You know, in other words, I was an indifferent history student, but suddenly here's, you know, a singing and dancing John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and whatnot. It just captivated me.
Sure.
You cannot
overstate.
Less
sassy, but still a little sassy Jefferson in that one.
Absolutely. And a very sassy Adams. And it was a commercial extravaganza. Man, by this time in 1976, CBS News nightly bicentennial minutes had been running, you know, every night for at least a year and a half, 2 years. I remember walking into the grocery store and seeing displays of Coke cans that were arranged in such a way that if you had all 50 state cans, it made a portrait of Uncle Sam. On and on and on. It was almost a cliche. I mean, it was schmaltzy, if anything. And those times were no less tumultuous than ours. You know, we were months away from the end of the Vietnam War and Watergate and whatnot, oil shocks, etc. So we were, you know, it's not as if we were, you know, a unified country then. But my fear, and I guess this is the prediction, it makes me sad to say this, Sarah. What is the 250th? The semi-sesquid? I cannot say this word.
Semi-quincentennial.
There you go. I'm just going to say the 250th.
That's allowed.
It's coming, and it's going to be a partisan affair. We have allowed ourselves in this country to have our feelings about this country caught up in the politics of the moment. You know, I love this country. When my guy is in office, I have misgivings about it. When your guy is in there. And as a result, I think we are robbing young people of the opportunity that I had as a young person to feel a kinship, to feel an attachment, to feel part of this country. And it just saddens me because this is literally a once in a lifetime opportunity, and we've already squandered it. I mean, you're not hearing very much discussion about this at all. It is not, you know, the level of celebration. And yes, even in its excesses, the extravaganza that it was in 1976. And I wonder if young people are going to miss the opportunity that I had as a young person. To feel a real attachment to this country, which again, when I think back over the facts of my life and how it shaped, you know, my attitudes and beliefs and values, and yes, patriotism, we're just going to miss that opportunity, and that just makes me sad.
Mark, what do you think about that?
Look, I don't think we're in the same place as we were in 1976. In 1976, there was one unified commission, that set up, I think that, you know, there were all these things that you talked about, right? There was a freedom train. There were moon rocks that went from town to town. There was a flotilla of tall ships.
The tall ships.
In New York. Even Ford, who was locked in a difficult presidential campaign, sort of relished the celebration. He later reportedly said that it had healed the nation's wounds, but I think that was a bit of an overstatement. What we have now is there was a commission that was set up before the Trump administration. The Bushes and the Obamas are honorary chairs. Mm-hmm. They had set up a series of events and sponsorships. But then Donald Trump came along, and they have, I think it's a Committee 250 or something. He's got his own commission. So the institutions in this country, whether it be the courts or the media or higher education in 1976, were in much better shape than they were now, and not nearly as divided. I mean, Donald Trump, and it is emblematic of Donald Trump. How is he going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of this country? What's his marquee event going to be? Anyone?
Wrestling.
UFC, right? Ultimate Fighting Championships.
Come on, Robert. So different.
Yeah, come on now.
Totally different.
At the White House, right? I mean, we're basically talk about like open conflict. Other than groin shots and foul language, you can use pretty much anything else you want when you fight the other guy. So I do think we've lost a lot. I think it shows how partisan we are, and it shows how degraded institutions that once stood as unifying factors, again, the media, the press, and even Congress, how degraded they've been. And I too mourn for the days when it was the bicentennial celebration. I think that was a much better state of affairs, well, frankly.
If I may, we just did it just now. We just illustrated on this discussion or in this discussion exactly my concern, which is we made it about Trump. Right. So the 250th will be about Trump.
Trump it, made it.
Fair enough. But the conversation will be about him. We can, you know, regardless of who initiated.
Well, but abstracted away from him. I mean, it's about that agenda and the degradation of institutions, no matter who it is at the helm of the group that's actively working to do all that.
No, I get it. But I guess my point, and, you know, as ever, I'm going to be guilty of putting on my teacher hat here. There's an historic opportunity for those of us who work with kids to use this occasion to teach children and to invest them in our institutions, Mark, you know, in our Constitution, in our traditions, in our values, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not going to do that because, oh, that would be giving a win to Trump.
Look, I guess, you know, I read something, and Kissinger, I'm going to get the quote wrong, but when Ford was talking about the event, Kissinger said something about our history, like there's nothing we can do for the past about the past. But Donald Trump doesn't accept that, right? He knows what Orwell said, which is if you control the present, you can control the past, right? And whoever controls the present can control the past. And once you control the past, that's how you get to the future. I mean, the mega people have realized that Orwellian paradox, and they're trying to exploit it. And we're going to see that even in the 250th celebration of our nation. Mm.
It's one of this has nothing to do with the political moment, but just a cultural shift. I remember so clearly because, again, I finished eighth grade. So I was, 13 years old. I was growing up on Long Island, the so-called tall ships, the Operation Sail. A lot of those boats were in Huntington Harbor, about 10 miles from where I lived. So one, you know, July morning, I got up on my bike and rode 10 miles to go see the tall ships without telling anybody where I was going, just what you did when you were a kid. Now there'd be an Amber Alert, you know, if I did that. So a lot of things have changed in the last 50 years, including our standards of parenting.
We are coming up against a break. I'll read a couple of emails before we throw over to a BBC newscast. Underreported story, this from Joanna Brown. What has happened to the 3,000 or more children taken away from their immigrant parents? These immigrant parents need financial support to sue the administration and hire investigators to locate these children. Where are they? Have they been shipped overseas? If so, where? Have they been adopted by families in the U.S.? These children should be found and placed back with their parents. We also heard from Matthew, who says the ongoing murder of Palestinians by Israel during the so-called ceasefire and the utter misery of people living in Gaza after Israel has destroyed all infrastructure and housing, the 70-plus year military occupation of Palestine, an explanation of the political movement known as Zionism, and the blatant hypocrisy of evangelical Christianity. That from Matthew. We will return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Happy New Year's Eve morning, or pleasant or calm, however you wish. Whatever adjective you prefer for your New Year's Eve morning, I send it to you. The panel this morning, Robert Pondicio, Mark Whitman, Judy Patrick returning shortly. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. The email address is panel@wamc.org. A little forward promotion. In the 11 o'clock, I will be wrapping up the year in music with Will Hermes. We're going to talk about some songs that hit, some bands we liked, and share some tunes. It is a tradition going on 15 years, nearly. We started in 2010. We've missed a couple years for a couple of different reasons, but we've been doing it for ages. We like it. Hopefully some listeners like it too. That will be on from 11 to noon. And we are on the panel this morning discussing underreported stories and making predictions for 2026. Let's talk about GLP-1s. Mark. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Sarah. I have good news, which is that in 2026, GLP-1s are going to fall off patent in India, China, and Brazil and other emerging markets, making them much cheaper. And generics will be accessible. If you look at the list of maladies that this broad class of drugs seems to have a beneficial effect on, not only does it include weight loss, which is, by the way, the cost of obesity in the United States costs our health system an estimated $260 billion a year. But these drugs also assist with type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea. It's believed that they may have a beneficial effect with respect to kidney disease
heart
and liver disease.
Heart
disease,
health.
Right. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's and cognitive decline, as well as inflammation across many organisms. And there's even evidence of reduced cravings and addiction. So now we don't know what the long-term effects are.
Which
but Frank,
is very important.
No.
Details.
Yeah, but look, I think if you look at the incredible pace of innovation,
sure.
I mean, we already have Western firms that are licensing Chinese discoveries. And the Indians are scaling up production at an amazing rate. The pill versions are coming, which allows for much easier compliance as well as distribution that doesn't necessarily have to be temperature chain monitored along the way.
Right. They've been injectables.
So the broad ripple effects of this are tremendous.
Do we know – sorry to interrupt, Mark, but do we know when these drugs are prescribed right now, how many of those prescriptions or what percentage are for things like type 2 diabetes versus weight loss?
I don't know that.
I'd love to know that data.
I don't know that we fully understand that. And a lot of the effects that the ancillary effects they've found, say on sleep apnea or even heart health outcomes, mm-hmm. they do know that they seem to be independent of how successful the patient is in losing weight on the drug. So they do think it's in some cases a somewhat, if not largely, independent effect. But these things are going to get a lot better in terms of efficacy, side effects, availability. And I think they're a big bright spot that isn't often celebrated as much as it should be. I'll close with a quote from, I think this is The Economist, that if they keep spreading and getting cheaper, this may be one of the rare times that medicine truly changes the world.
Oh, it already has.
And sure. I mean, in Hollywood, it has.
No.
But I mean, this is
going to
have a global
yeah.
effect. The other good news piece, Sarah, and I didn't send this in to you, is I keep seeing estimates that by 2050, half of the power on this planet will come from electricity. Half of the power, not just electricity, but half of the power in this country will come from solar panels. In Pakistan, they got hold of cheap Chinese panels and batteries at such a rate that people are leaving the grid, and there's now what they call a death spiral, because if you're still paying for electricity from the utility, you're getting hammered with the cost because they can't spread the fixed cost amongst as many patrons, and it's just accelerating. I think they're using 12% less electricity off the grid in Pakistan on an annual basis because solar panels and the battery technology are becoming so cheap. I think it is terrible what this administration has done to the
renewable energy sector.
Well, and the environment broadly. I think we got away this year that Mother Nature didn't slap us as hard as she has in past years, and may in 2026. That's a gamble that's going to cost us at some point in the not too distant future. But I am very hopeful that renewables are now so economically compelling that even though it may take us longer than it should to get there, that economics are going to force the planet to get there.
Can we go back to GLP-1s for a second?
Because yeah.
You're absolutely right about the world changing revolution that they are ushering in. That said, okay, let me inject the note of caution here. Are we at risk of medicalizing lifestyle and habit here? This is why I was asking Mark about what percentage of the prescriptions are for lifestyle stuff, if you like, for weight loss as opposed to diabetes, heart disease, sleep apnea, and whatnot. I don't want to be that guy. However, what happens to us as a society when drugs replace self-control, culture, personal responsibility, etc.? I see parallels to antidepressants here. In other words, yes, there are real benefits, but there's also the potential for overuse. And any view of that, Mark?
Look, I'm going to answer that question with a subtly different answer than maybe you expect. I think one of the benefits of this drug is it's removed some of the stigma around why it is people are at weights that are unhealthy for mm-hmm. them. And I think that's one of the benefits here. And in a way, I'd say it doesn't matter. I do think there's mm-hmm. a risk that, you've got people in the Hamptons who knowingly get drunk and then show up at these sober tanks that they pay enormous amounts for the next day. And certainly that we would all consider as abusive. But I think broadly, you know, the notion that, you know, it's your fault and you just need to do something different is now going to be irrelevant with these medications to some extent. And I think that's a great effect. I'll tell you a little story. I used to work out at this gym. It was crazy. Half the people there competed in competitions. You go look up the guy's picture. Orville Burke was the guy's name. He's one of those guys that won these bodybuilding competitions. Everybody would sort of yield. And if he wanted the machine and you were walking to it, you let him get there. But there was one guy who was worked out at this gym who was recovering from a stroke. He had to work out with, we assume it was his wife. Orville would always give the right of way to that guy. And somebody once asked him, what are you doing? You're the bodybuilder. Orville looked at him and said, nobody's working harder in this gym than that guy. Hmm. And I think GLP get us to the point where it doesn't matter why it is you woke up the way you did and the health state you are. It allows us to say, look, if you've got to address something, then let's do everything we can to help you out without that judgment. And I think that's the right approach.
Where does concern about cost regulation, big pharma, and the Trump administration's effort to lower the cost of GLP-1s enter the fray?
My understanding is they're trying to make it more broadly available. I'd applaud that. I think what we do in the United States will matter to 380 million people, but the rest of the 8 billion people in the planet that may benefit from this won't be that directly affected from what in terms of what we do in the U.S. As I said, the Chinese and the Indians already have unique science going on around this class of drugs. So as a global health issue, the good news is we in the United States probably can't mess it up. And it does seem to me that in the United States, even with the Trump administration, we seem to be generally heading the right way. This is a huge – if we get this right and the long-term effects are – remember, this is medication, okay? Mm-hmm. But if the long-term effects long-term effects are swamped by the benefits, as it looks like they will be, this has could have huge implications on our healthcare system in the United States and save our government a heck of a lot of money, frankly.
Welcome back, Judy Patrick.
I'm glad to be back here. It's a great media project.
Good.
It airs Friday at 3, Sundays at 6.
Yep.
We talk about the future. Didn't talk too much about 25, so it was fun.
As you return, would you like to mention an underreported story?
I will, because I think this is a story many of you may never have heard of. So, and it's a local story. What it is there was a $50 billion settlement for opioid by the companies that marketed opioids, and that $50 million was distributed to the states and to the localities. And there's a real issue about how that money will be spent. It's much like the tobacco settlement money from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And what we're not seeing is a lot of reporting about what the counties, what the states are doing. Are they spending this money on prevention? Are they spending the money on treatment? We are focused so heavily in this country on, you know, stopping the flow of drugs into our country. What we're not spending a lot of time is discussing treatment and prevention. And with this huge pot of money, I mean, from a local reporting perspective, we always like to follow the money and hold people accountable. I just want to make sure that this money is spent wisely, that this money is spent and the people who are in charge of distributing it are held accountable. It's one of those issues that it's tough to report on, and especially nowadays when a lot of these localities don't have newspapers in their backyard and don't have the time and resources to report on the decisions being made. Somebody has to do it. There's a great resource out of West Virginia. West Virginia was one of the states that was hit hardest by opioid overdoses. And they have a coalition down there that has it's a great resource in terms of trying to analyze some of what's happening. Again, it's a real issue. You have to make a decision about where you're spending the money, make sure it's being spent wisely, and just asking those kind of questions. So that is a story that I would love to see continue to be covered. I've seen little dribs and drabs of it, but I have hardly ever seen anything major done on it, in part because this is a local story, and it needs to be one that we all pursue.
You know, I just saw, and I wish I knew where I saw this, Judy, but because you just reminded me, this would have been a good thing to talk about had I done my homework properly. Am I correct in saying that the number of opioid deaths and drug overdose deaths in general is dropping rather dramatically in the last couple of years? That's good news.
It definitely has dropped, yeah. In fact, NPR does a good job. Brian Mann up in the North Country, he works for NPR, and he is a really great reporter covering these issues. And yeah, and it has dropped. But we all probably have been in communities where you see the number of opioid deaths was incredible.
Yeah.
And again, this money is flowing. And some of it's still being disputed. A lot of these decisions are being made at the state level, but again, I think it's being distributed county agencies as well, and I think those questions need to be asked.
Thoughts or comments on that, Mark? Or do you want to start a new one?
No, I've always said about what we're doing in the Caribbean or what's being done in our name, you can't bomb addiction. And if you really want to solve the drug crisis in this country, the demand will always find a supply. We need to work on the demand side of this equation.
Let's talk about China. The big noise in 2025 has been President Donald Trump launching a barrage of executive orders. He directed his fire at target after target. This from The Economist. With the aid of Elon Musk early in the year, he attempted to dismantle the federal bureaucracy. On Liberation Day, he rewrote the rules of trade around the world. He imposed peace and threatened war. However, the big beneficiary has been President Xi Jinping. This year, China defied Trump's attempts to use tariffs to force a show of submission. By turning the tables, President Xi revealed just how much America actually depends on his policies in this round of the superpowers' fight for the 21st century. This, again, according to The Economist, it was a victory for China. Mark.
Yeah, Donald Trump did it wrong. If he wanted to fix world trade, he should have circled up all our allies and gone after China. Even, frankly, if after you solve the China problem, you then go after your allies to refine their policies. He did it wrong. Xi has benefited both economically and geopolitically. He will take a lot of the space on the field that the United States is ceding by virtue of our withdrawal of aid and our withdrawal of support for allies. The one irony here is that Donald Trump's biggest assist domestically came from Xi Jinping. Why? Because if Trump had been successful in slapping the tariffs that he wanted, the self-induced inflation that Trump has already admitted is taking place by the fact that he's rolling back tariffs on some items would have been even worse. Mm. So honest to God, not only has Donald Trump made China greater, right? He literally, his policies are so ill-conceived that his biggest domestic assist this year came from Xi Jinping. I think that's been underreported, frankly.
Robert or Judy?
Yeah, not my strength. I defer to Mark on that. You know, I give this president high marks for certain aspects of his foreign policy, particularly Iran and the Middle East. His affection for tariffs eludes me. Even if it does seem to be benefiting my 401k at the moment, I don't know. I don't think it's a sensible long-term economic posture.
All I know is my Beaujolais Nouveau that I'll buy for tonight.
Yes.
It's going to be more expensive than it was last year. Also, and a more serious note, the conventional wisdom about the Chinese economy at the beginning of the year was that it was struggling, that it needed to build up its consumer base. But then, you know, in the last month or 6 weeks, what we're hearing are really positive economic indicators out of China. So, again, sometimes with economic indicators, Mark, I don't know what to believe and what not to believe.
I think China's still challenged. It's not as dark as it was. And if you look at the United States, frankly, part of the reason we're going to have reasonable growth, you know, we may get to 2% GDP growth this year, despite all the headwinds, is because the international environment looks pretty good. And believe it or not, a lot of, you know, the government shutdown, the benefits of that are now going to fall into next year. And so, too, what I'll call a sugar high from the tax cuts around investment will also feather into next year. So Trump started last year with a great economic setup. He diminished it somewhat by playing chicken with tariffs. He's going into this coming year, actually, with a pretty reasonable economic setup. We should get to 2% growth in the economy, although inflation will stay higher than the Fed wants it to be. The question is, does he ruin it again with economic chicken, either around the Federal Reserve or something else that spooks the markets? The good news is Trump does seem to listen to the markets. Yeah. They do seem to be a regulator on his behavior. So he seems to only go so far to the extent that the market can show him they don't like what he's doing.
He seems to listen to the bond market more than
the— Yeah, the bond market, believe it or not, look, the stock market is richly valued and stretched. But the bond market is where the immediate risk is. One of my big regrets on this program is when the gilt crisis in the U.K. happened.
Yeah, me too.
Years back.
I've been thinking about it every single day.
And I was asked about its significance by Alan Chartok, and I didn't realize. I mean, he whether he saw it or not, I think I'm going to credit him and say he did. Mm-hmm. It foretold the danger that we face in the United States, which is the bond market can be very brittle. And if investors decide you're no longer the same, that there's a lot more risk associated with the bet than they thought yesterday, they can cause pretty violent disruptions that would then lead into the stock market and eventually the real economy. So that's where the canary in our coal mine exists, and that's why there's so much concern around what Trump may try and be able to do, for instance, around the Fed, even though, let's be clear, the effect of what they do won't actually be felt for quite some time in the future. The fear of that effect is what may cause the bond market to seize. The good news is taco. Trump does chicken out when the markets discipline him. So, you know, as much as I don't like the guy, I do like his predilection to step away from the fire when it gets too hot on economic events.
Do you have to fuel the flames first? Do you? Not you.
No,
one.
Yeah, you wish you didn't, but maybe it's better to have a failsafe than not.
Is his another failsafe for the president a crypto investment? Let's talk about that.
Oh, look, thank you for this. Look, the Financial Times did
You're
this.
Not exactly welcome, but I'm happy to discuss it.
No, look, we can do this quickly. If you look at Trump's endeavors, there is no president in modern history that's got this intermingling of personal wealth and his office. Literally pardoning people who buy the currencies within the enterprises he and his family are involved with, right? Holding dinners as president with people who invest in private enterprises, having states literally, you know, not only the airplane, but allegedly, you know, states that have made multi-million dollars investments. I think one runs into the billions in his cryptocurrencies. The intermingling, I'm not going to call it corruption because I don't want to be sued, but the intermingling of the family personal and the wealth accumulation by Trump and his family is a story that will take a decade for forensic accountants to untangle, and it will be a story that we have never seen, even during, say, the Grant administration, which was one of the worst times of that was outright corruption in this country. It is pitiful. And the problem is the Supreme Court never ruled on emoluments to begin with. So we don't have a stick. You know, there's not a legal way to make this stop while it's taking place, even though we know what it is and it's been somewhat reported. I got to tell you, if this were Edwin Meese back in the Reagan days, it would be on the front page of the paper on a regular basis.
But there's so many more interesting things to talk about, Mark, like UFC fighting for the 250th, like renaming the Kennedy Center, etc. I mean, I'm not somebody who suffers from Trump derangement syndrome, but I do hold the media accountable here for trying to keep us in a constant state of alarm over less serious matters. I completely agree with you. The emoluments issue is a profound one, but it's a heavy intellectual lift, right? So we're just no longer prepared as a country to have those serious conversations when we can be distracted by trivia or relative trivia.
By the way, I love the fact that Trump put his name on the Kennedy Center. I really do, and I'll tell you why.
Can't wait to hear this.
Because I think I think the populace, even those who don't. You aren't slaves to news like we are. I think middle America realizes how absurd it is. I do think the emperor is starting to be far less well-clothed, even in sort of all of America. And I think doing silly things like, I just wish he would put it in front of either the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Monument. No, I'm serious. But I'm entirely serious because I have no doubt we will scrape those damn letters off this stuff when he is done. But I think we are peak Trump. But I think he will hasten his own demise with this nonsense and this gilded stuff that he's spewing all over the place.
I actually mentioned this last time I was on the roundtable. Again, I'm not somebody who suffers from Trump derangement syndrome, but I am definitely someone who is suffering from Trump fatigue syndrome, where it is just too much. The constant barrage of less substantial issues, his taking up all the airtime. I remember there was an issue with Clinton fatigue, you know, back in the day. And now
just
I think
a kid. I don't
even of course okay. Those of us with some gray hair.
Got some.
Yeah, I think we are now getting to the point where even those of us who are not rabidly anti-Trump are just like enough already.
Judy.
There's so much news to report every day. And on the emoluments issue, on the graft, greed, and corruption issue, if you read newspapers, you'll be well informed of a lot of what's happening. And they will pay passing notice to the fact that the weigh-in for the UFC championship is going to be in front of the Lincoln Memorial. I think they don't make a huge deal of it, but that will grab the nation's attention. Those are the kinds of things that people will care about. I think that the Edwin Meese analogy is a good one, but even when Edwin Meese was doing things, it wasn't something that every American knew about. If you polled Americans today about the Kennedy Center, you'll get a lot of familiarity with that issue. I'm not sure everybody knows about the weigh-in in front of the Lincoln Memorial for the fighters yet, or the fact that it's the breaking of norms. There's so much. I mean, as we've spent the last week going through what happened in 2025, I think we've all gotten a sense of all the things that happened. That it's hard to keep up, and the year in review stories have come at us fast and furious, and in some respects, it's been very depressing to read all the things. Oh, I forgot about he did this, or I forgot he did that. And I think it's the collective, the accumulation of that can be very depressing, can be very overpowering. And it's not so much this idea of Trump derangement syndrome. I think it's used as a diss on anyone who brings up anything about Trump. I mean, the fact that he put his name on the Kennedy Center is kind of a very symbolic of what he's doing. And it just raises all sorts of questions about where he stands in his life.
We are out of time for the roundtable for today, for the roundtable panel for today, and in fact, for this year. Judy Patrick, Robert Pondicio, Mark Whitman, thank you for being here today and throughout the year. We thank all of our roundtable participants for their excellent participation. That's redundant. I apologize for being redundant in the last sentences of the roundtable panel for this year. In the coming hour, a music chat with Will Hermes. Thank you for listening and Happy New Year.